This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, in which we answer your questions. Your questions may be sent to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we will endeavor to answer as many of them as possible. And a very happy Easter and Passover to those of you out there celebrating or having had celebrated. I hope it was a pleasant holiday for you and your families. How are you? Did you have fun, Layla?
Yes, I did. How about yourself?
Okay, yeah, very nice. Very nice weekend spent with friends and family. And and finally, hopefully, the cold winter is behind us. We seem to have turned a corner. You know, the temperature's easing up, and maybe it's over. You know, unless for opening day of baseball. There's going to be, you know, this is one of the traditions in baseball is that they start the baseball season in a place like Detroit or Minnesota, and it's a snowstorm. I know that, you know, having visited the baseball stadium in Minneapolis, it's fun there because you go there and there's a fireplace there. So you can warm yourself by the fireplace in the early part of the season because sometimes when baseball season starts, it's still pretty cold up there in the north.
Yeah. Oh, well. Well, it's still April.
Okay. Well, April is the cruelest month, as T.S. Eliot once said, and we never know what we're going to get. Probably a fair amount of rain and a few more cold days, but it should be finally.
I think it's safe to put away the snow boots, but now that I've said it, I don't know.
I put away my super winter coats, which got some mileage. Got some mileage this winter. All right, so this week, let's tackle some questions.
Okay.
What's going on? What do people have on their minds?
First question is from Mark. He writes, can you tell me if Endosin has a high glycemic load?
Okay.
Mark, no, it doesn't. Endosin is something we use for upper GI problems like GERD, esophageal distress, gastritis, things of that nature. And really, the only sugars in Endosin are xylitol and some D-mannose, and that's about it. It's not a high glycemic load. It's highly therapeutic.
Right. Why don't you tell listeners about Endosin? Because, you know, it's actually one of the great undiscovered secrets for management of gastrointestinal problems. And I have to give you credit for having vetted it with our patients because I knew about it. And I said, well, maybe you want to try it. And then you worked with a lot of our patients who suffer from GERD and various gastrointestinal problems. And many of our patients have come to rely on it. It's fabulous. So tell us about what that is and what conditions it's good for.
Endosin is actually a product that contains a lot of nutrients like arabinogalactins. It's got phosphatides, it's got astaxanthin, mannose, as I said, green tea extract. What it does is supports the integrity of the gastric lining, the lining of the stomach, and it promotes the growth of new cells. It promotes the thickness, the strength of that very protective layer. And it also promotes the growth of healthy bifidobacteria and lactobacillus bacteria so that we have a healthy balanced flora. And and as you know, when we've got good healthy flora, that supports our immune system and GI tract function, so a lot of things. It's beneficial for a lot of things. It also helps to promote short chain fatty acids, which is very interesting. So it's good for a whole lot of things, Endosin.
And so typically, what type of patient would be a candidate for Endosin?
Somebody who comes in with intractable GERD or acid reflux, or somebody who's had acid reflux, have been put on PPIs for life, like Nexium or Prilosec, and they want to get off, and we put them on Endosin. We tell them to also take DGL, as you start to wean them off of their medications.
Mm-hmm. Which has to be done slowly and carefully, because there's a real rebound that occurs with these medications. It's hard to taper off. It's actually one of the reasons why these medications are so successful. Many people believe that they can never get off them, because as soon as they try to go off them, their GERD symptoms come back with a vengeance. They get stomach pain, and they think that they really need the medication. It's actually because you get hyperacidity if you go off too quickly. So you have to taper slowly. And Endofen is a great, shall we say, transitional agent to help patients bridge the gap between the use of these acid blockers and weaning off.
Yeah.
And then, of course, part of the strategy, of course, is dietary, and you recommend a dietary approach for patients. So could you briefly outline the approach you might use?
Well, there's more avoidance than anything. First of all, if somebody who has GERD or gastritis, the common advice is to get off anything that's spicy or hot, deep-fried, very greasy foods. Obviously, we don't want anybody to eat deep-fried or greasy foods. But also things like chocolate, tomato products, coffees and teas, things that are very acidic. Citrus fruits are another one. Certain stone fruits like peaches.
Vinegars, perhaps, balsamic vinegar or something.
Yeah, vinegar, things of that nature. Carminatives, peppermint. People think peppermint tea is a wonderful digestive. Peppermint tea is very good for like lower belly gas and bloat and for digestion.
Lower.
But it's not good for GERD.
For upper stuff, yeah, because it loosens the esophageal sphincter.
Yeah.
Okay. And then...
And gluten.
And right. And
very big deal, gluten. And we find that even those without any gluten sensitivity at all benefit. They feel much better. Their GERD symptoms go away when they embark on a gluten-free diet.
And that's the fermentation principle. And I think that one of the things that you learned while working with Dr. Atkins is that many patients with gastrointestinal problems did better on a higher protein, lower sugar and starch diet.
Yes, yes. And as soon as they cheated and they would eat bread or something, Dr. Hoffman, the GI symptoms come back with a vengeance. It really, really did. I saw this all the time.
And, of course, then there's also the DGL, which is the licorice extract, which you can, I think a lot of people try it. They say, I tried it and it didn't work. Well, the problem is you didn't try it in conjunction with Endofen. And a diet change. And also, some people kind of skimp on the DGLs. Well, I took a couple. No, you have to chew on those things all day long. They're
right.
Like
you need
lozenges.
Right, 6 to 10 a day.
Yeah. And they're relatively inexpensive, so you're not going to run up a big bill. But just, suck on the lozenges the way you might suck on candies. And they're usually made with a calorie-free or very low-calorie base to, licorice is sweet on its own. It doesn't need to be sweetened very much.
Exactly. Another reason people shy away from DGLs, they say, oh no, it's licorice. I have high blood pressure or licorice interferes with my medication. Well, this is deglycerized licorice.
Mm-hmm.
The glycyrrhizic acid, which is what would cause or exacerbate a high blood pressure, has been removed.
Right. And
so
heart patients need to be concerned about licorice, because especially if you're taking a diuretic, it already depletes your potassium. If you take licorice, it's double trouble, because it'll further deplete your. You can, that is one medical interaction, but in this case, it's the part that raises your blood pressure, causes you to retain sodium, and lowers your potassium, is eliminated in the processing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that great. That covers it. And so Endofen,
Mark, you can take your Endofen.
Right.
It's Endefen.
Right. And a word about it is that you will not find it in retail nutritional pharmacies or drugstores, because it's not available through normal retail outlets. It's available only through doctors, and you can get it as part of our Hoffman Center dispensary online. Click on drhoffman.com and click on the store. And if you search for DGL, I think you can put DGL in the search box, you'll be able to find it. Or look under gastrointestinal agents, because we have it. We list our products by category, and that will lead you to Endofen. Or you can also type into Google Endofen Hoffman Center, and that's a way that you can get a hold of the product. It's a very, very useful product. And so how do you take it?
What you generally do is you take 2 level tablespoons and enough water for it to dissolve, maybe a half a cup.
Okay, so it's not a pill.
You take it twice a day, preferably in between meals.
Okay.
And that's the way to take Endofen.
Yeah, I wanted to spend a little time on that because that's actually a way that a lot of people have achieved wellness with these types of conditions without even having to come see us. Although, you know, a trip to the Hoffman Center to troubleshoot mm-hmm. is often helpful. And, you know, you can actually see Layla without seeing me if you already have a doctor. And, you know, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. But
yes.
to paraphrase our eminent president, but if you'd like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, but go see Layla and she'll give you the nutritional aspects of the program.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mark, for your question.
Yeah.
The next question comes from Mary. Hello, Dr. Hoffman. I'm searching for a natural prescription to help my macular degeneration. I'd like to have a pill or capsule that incorporates most, if not all, of the important natural components. Any advice?
Okay. So we have that kind of product, and we sort of carefully select the products that we have at the store at the Hoffman Center. Which one did we opt for? I always forget the name because it's
the ocular?
Ocular something?
Support, yes.
Ocular support, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the components of a good supplement for macular degeneration? Why don't we go through those?
We definitely want some lutein, zeaxanthin. We definitely want some bilberry. DHA is important, the DHA of EPA and DHA, meaning mm-hmm. fish oil, is also very important.
Zinc,
of the carotenoids.
Antioxidants, some maybe alpha lipoic acid, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Selenium in some cases. Because those are the things that have been shown to be helpful.
Yeah. It's clinical ocular care
okay.
the actual product.
Clinical ocular
care.
Okay. And, you know, there's a product, I think it's called OcuGuard or something like that, by Bausch & Lomb, and it's pretty good, but it's not really that rich in some of the, should we say, less mainstream nutrients. It covers the bases in terms of the antioxidants, but we find that products that are not commercial, this is made by Bausch & Lomb, which is, of course, the company that makes a lot of eye products. And they capitalized on the interest in nutritional products for the eyes because really that's the only thing that really works for macular degeneration. So they said, okay, let's make a supplement. Their supplement is a little bit like the one-a-day multivitamin for eyes,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty conservative. And the doses are kind of, okay, but not exactly resoundingly potent.
Not a therapeutic dose.
Right. And
yeah.
So that's why...
that's the difference.
Yeah, that's why we suggest our product. That's pretty much it.
Thank you for your question, Mary, and best of luck. Our next question is from Carol. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I wondered if you could speak in depth about psoriasis. I have a very bad case on my arm.
Right.
I'm 65. I'm away from grains and dairy, mostly paleo, all of that. But this condition, you know, can come back with a vengeance. And I've heard that people with psoriasis are more prone to cancer and heart disease. Is this true?
Okay, well, let's tackle the last part first. Psoriasis is an inflammatory disorder. So, yes, it's actually been shown, especially if you have psoriatic arthritis, that you are more prone to heart attack and stroke because what affects the superficial skin, you know, it seems like a superficial condition, but actually it's a systemic condition, as is seen in especially psoriatic arthritis, where you can see deep within the joints, there's inflammation. But that inflammation is pervasive, and it may actually affect the blood vessels.
Mm.
So, and cancer, when it comes to cancer, I think that's possible, is that people with psoriasis are more prone to cancer. But I think the connection is as robust as it is for cardiovascular and circulatory disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't there some association, Dr. Hoffman, with untreated autoimmune conditions possibly or being a risk factor for developing a cancer later on in life, or am I off?
You know, there possibly is for cancers like lymphoma. Part of the problem is that many of these conditions are treated with powerful immunosuppressive drugs, and you may suppress the immune system or distort the immune system. And one of the side effects of drugs used, powerful drugs used for rheumatoid arthritis, is lymphoma, which is an immune cancer.
Wow. So it seems like Carol's already on the right track, removing grains, removing dairy. It's especially important, the grains and the casein, especially gluten and casein, possibly looking at food allergies. But with regard to help for skin, what do we like? We like zinc, we like borage oil, we like
certainly
C.
Vitamin D.
Vitamin D.
Although there's some argument about whether the vitamin D should be obtained through oral supplementation. Certainly oral supplementation is helpful, but it appears that making the vitamin D in the skin with light therapy works even better than just taking oral vitamin D.
UV radiation.
Because the vitamin D gets made precisely where it's needed, which is in the skin layer where the psoriasis is occurring. So the other thing that might be helpful is something that people cannot purchase over the counter. It's low-dose naltrexone, helpful for many autoimmune conditions. I've helped some patients with psoriasis with low-dose naltrexone. Look it up at ldninfo.org. It's a low dose of a medication that is used for treatment of opiate addiction. That doesn't sound too savory, does it?
But it seems to have nothing to do with this at all, but
It works on your endorphin system when used in very small doses. There's no side effects, and it helps to reboot the immune system because the immune system here is attacking itself or attacking the body, making an erroneous U-turn and attacking whatever organ it targets. Another aspect of this, and I think you'll agree, Leila, is the leaky gut syndrome, whereby gastrointestinal problems, bacterial overgrowth, candida, or a change in the permeability of the intestinal tract allows toxins from bacteria and yeast and or food antigens to traverse directly into the circulation. And through something called molecular mimicry, the body perceives these residues as foreign invaders and then proceeds to attack whatever. It could attack your skin, or it could attack your joints, or it could attack your brain in multiple sclerosis, your thyroid and autoimmune thyroiditis. We really look at the gut connection in autoimmune disease these days.
We find that often that's a precursor to an autoimmune presentation. So that's, a lot of people walking around with leaky gut from bad diets, stress, taking too many NSAIDs, your aspirin, your Tylenol, your ibuprofen, all of those things on a regular basis. Too much alcohol also will cause a leaky gut. Eating your food allergy foods that you should be avoiding can cause a leaky gut. Lots of things can cause a leaky gut.
Yep.
Antibiotics possibly, because it will cause the growth of candida, and a candida overgrowth will tend to cause a leaky gut.
One of our guests recently discussed something that he likes to use for leaky gut, which is something that we use. We don't pretend not to think of it for leaky gut. We use it for immune system. Maybe indirectly it works on it, but it's colostrum, or sometimes referred to as transfer factor. But the idea being that the gut is an immune organ, and it needs to be properly conditioned. And colostrum, the first milk, actually primes the gastrointestinal tract to have a normal immune response.
Yeah.
So, this might be one of the ways we can treat leaky gut is through administration of colostrum supplements or transfer factor.
Yeah. I mean, the gut is 70-75% of our immune system via the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, GALT.
And let's not forget fish oil. Tons of fish oil for people with just dry, flaky skin. Although psoriasis is far more than just dry skin, but there's an element of that. And, other things that can be helpful for
borage oil is helpful. Yeah.
Sure. And, in terms of topical, I've treated mild, a couple of spots of psoriasis with Manuka oil cream. Which is very nice anti-inflammatory. I mean, but if your body is like covered with scales and you have deep-seated plaque, the Manuka is not going to do that much. But for dry patches on your elbows, knees, fingers, the Manuka mm-hmm. cream can be very helpful. And that's
great.
Something that, again, that's actually, yeah. I think that's still, if you go to our website, that's our featured product this month because it's such a versatile skincare product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I use it for everything. I use it as my aftershave.
I love Manuka. Wonderful stuff.
Yep.
Thank you, Carol, for your question.
Okay, we have time for another question in this segment, so fire away.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. This comes from Judy. My husband's homocysteine was a 17.4, and now he's taking Methyl Guard Plus and Methyl B Complex. What else should he do to lower his homocysteine?
Well, he sounds like he's on the right track. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Now, has this person just started, right? He just started to take those things?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's going to take a couple of months, isn't it?
Well, let's explain what this is. Okay, so first of all, homocysteine is a byproduct of inefficient metabolism of methionine. And methionine is a dietary component, and it is transformed via methylation to less harmful byproducts. Mm-hmm. Part of the transformation is to turn it into, there's SAMe is involved in that. Mm-hmm. And then, homocysteine is a unmetabolized residue. And homocysteine is associated with higher risk of heart disease, but in particular, cerebrovascular disease and dementia. So recently, we know this, I think, in our last podcast, that folate is something that helps to prevent stroke, and it also prevents dementia, particularly if you have a high homocysteine. If you already have a low homocysteine, the effect is not that dramatic. It's a little bit like, if you have a very
homocysteine that's the driving force. So once that's lowered by the folate,
exactly.
Kind of takes care of matters, right?
Exactly. So in other words, the people who have low cholesterol, they don't need to take statin. It's not going to help them that much. But say they had a high cholesterol, sometimes that helps. So similarly, folate helps to lower homocysteine and thereby helps to reduce stroke. Now, I have to say that it was a little disappointing when they did a study with B vitamins in heart disease. One study showed that people who have heart disease, that they took B vitamins for a while, and it didn't lower the risk of subsequent heart attacks or death. Well, part of the problem is they already had advanced heart disease. Part of the problem is the study was too short. They did not use methylated B vitamins or high-quality B vitamins. So there were some faults in the study. But I think that the biggest potential for the use of the B vitamin, and by the way, it's not just folate, it's B6 and methyl cobalamin that will help mm-hmm. this. And that's actually incorporated in a product that we have called Methyl Guard, which is, guards against methylation problems, appropriately called Methyl Guard. But so the point is that we can lower the risk of stroke, heart attack. Also, high homocysteine individuals have a higher risk of passing along birth defects. And another way of putting your finger on this is now through the new genetic tests that we now do, where we can actually look at MTHFR, which is a gene locus, and we can see if people are having problems with one or another site on that gene. And that, again, is a predictor of a wide variety of health problems, not just stroke or dementia. But this is, we're getting into a whole new area in the field
of
complementary medicine.
It's so much fun. I mean, this is just another tool in the toolbox now, being able to do this genetic testing and find out, hey, guess what? You don't methylate well, so you don't take folic acid in the multi anymore. You have to take your B vitamins this way. And it's a simple fix.
Yeah.
But, it's a wonderful thing to know that, okay, this is what's going on, and I could take care of these risk factors this way.
But here's what my experience shows me is that there's some people who have like a minor homocysteine problem. First, we'd like homocysteine to be about, 6 or 7. That would be good. Certainly under 10. Mm-hmm. There's some people who start with a rip-roaring high homocysteine, 25 or 26. These are people who are hard to get below two digits. a person who has maybe a 12 or something, they can just take Methylguard and they'll be fine. But there's some people who are very hard to get that down. It's genetic to some extent. It's not their fault. It's not a bad diet. So they need to take higher doses of folate. They may need to take betaine or betaine. It's also referred to as trimethylglycine. Mm-hmm. And there you need to take gram amounts. You need to take like 3 grams of TMG sometimes to get that down. The best we can do for some people is to get it into, the low teens or down to 12 or 11. That I consider a success if somebody comes in with a homocysteine of like 27. This is, it also can be related to, we sometimes see it with patients who have uncorrected thyroid problems. That can actually have an impact. Homocysteine, by the way, gets even more complicated. Is there may be higher risk for certain cancers with high homocysteine because improper methylation increases the risk for breast cancer, for example. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's probably more information than this person wants to know. What we need to see is how well her husband responds to this Methylguard. And
when would you normally then do another blood test for homocysteine?
Three months,
taking Methylguard Plus.
Give it some time, and then we'll see how well you do, and then we decide if you have to go to other measures.
Right. Thank you for your great question, Judy, and best of luck to your husband.
Okay, and now indeed we do have to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts, as those of you are accustomed to listening to Q&A with Layla know. In part two, what's coming up? Give us a preview.
How guaranteed are guaranteed diets?
Whoa, that's a loaded question.
Yeah.
All right, when we return in part two, we'll tackle that important question. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.